How is everybody feeling? Last session of the conference. Looking out there, people look a little bit crispy maybe. Too much content, too much stuff. So I could have the philosophy of give you energy, try to boost you up, carry you through this last session, or just hit you with a 400 level session and finish you off for the week. Maybe a mixture of the two. Now I'm going to be talking about security today. A friend of mine and one of the guys on the product team, Sesh Imani, is up here. And you ever see like the small guy going into a bar with a really big guy, and the small guy's really tough because he knows the bad guy's to pick him up? So I'm going to be really tough because he's there to kind of back up and answer questions. But as we go through, I think some of your scenarios are going to get beyond what I can cover in the 75-minute talk. You know, so we're kind of committed to afterwards, if you still have things, just to kind of come up and answer questions until we're all done. So, and sir, you are allowed to correct me at any point as we're going through the session. Now, as far as who am I, I'm Ted Pattison. I've been doing technical training and different stuff for about 15, 20 years. I've been a SharePoint MVP for 10 years. I own a company called Critical Path Training. So just wanted to kind of show you the website. If you kind of like this type of delivery of the content, you know, we have some pretty good hands-on training classes that you can take remotely. I'm also happy to talk to you about that afterwards. Okay, so what are we going to talk about in today's session? Well, we're going to start with just a overview of app security. You know, kind of what we wanted to cover here is a, you know, front-to-back look at SharePoint app security. So we're going to cover internal authentication, we're going to cover S2S, we're going to cover OAuth, and we're going to cover permissions along the way, just to give you a good idea about external versus internal and the different types of external authentication as we go. Okay, now, there are these issues that we had with FARM full trust solutions. So let's just kind of start with the motivation of where we came from had some serious issues. Okay, so I'm guessing that a good number of you, you know, probably over 90% of you, have been writing FARM solutions for SharePoint 2007 and 2010. So let's say you're writing a FARM solution and you're writing a web part or code behind an application page, you know, and by default, your code is always executing in the context of the current user. Okay, that's great. Your code can do exactly what the current user can do. And there's a scenario where you're trying to do something, maybe create a new list because you want a hidden list for logging, yet the current user is only a contributor, has no permissions to create a list, so your code basically can't do that. So what we all know is that there's that little back door where you call SP security, run with elevated privileges. How many people have called that method and felt good about themselves afterwards? Most of us, okay. So basically you start running as, you know, a godlike presence inside of SharePoint, and we can do what we want. Now, one of the issues that we have is we need elevation, but we don't want to just hand over the keys to the kingdom, you know, to the developer who's making the call. Now, let's look at sandbox solutions. Sandbox solutions, you have code behind a web part, it's always running in the context of the current user. But there's this issue where if the current user can't do something in a sandbox, you can't elevate. You're out of luck. Now, there's the too little permissions problem. We saw that, you know, there's the too much permissions problem. But the other thing about sandbox solutions is everybody says they're safe, they protect everything. Well, they protect the SharePoint farm. They protect every other site collection except for the one you care about. So if I write a sandbox solution and I have code in feature activation, who do you have to be able to upload and activate that sandbox solution? You have to be someone who has site collection administration privileges. And so my code runs with site collection administration privileges. You cannot stop that from happening. And if I'm a malicious programmer, I can basically delete every piece of content inside your site collection. You know, so the core issue that we have is that code has to run as a current user. You know, whether it's wingtip slash Bob or it's SharePoint slash system, and there's nothing we really have to constrain what the code can do outside of that user context. Now, certainly back in 2003 and 2007, we went down this road where we had the bin directory and code access security policies, you know, but that just proved to be too hard to really pull off. So, as we move forward, you know, we need something that's a little bit better than that. Now, let's kind of get a little bit abstract and talk about what is a security principle. It's some entity that wants to do something, wants access to resources, wants to make calls into a SharePoint site from across the network. So you can think of the security principle as any type of entity that can be understood by the security system, and we can start configuring authorization because we see some particular identity inside there. So you know examples of security principles. Obviously, users, they get Active Directory accounts, they can log in, they have an identity. You know, other things that we have is Windows identities, forms-based authentication identities, FBA roles. If you add a computer to an Active Directory domain, it becomes a first-class security principle. And so now what we have with SharePoint and the app model in 2013 is this whole idea that the app takes on its own identity. And that is a huge step forward compared to what we had with Farm Solution. So SharePoint 2010, we didn't have apps yet, so we only had user authentication. And so SharePoint 2013 has to add in support to authenticate the app in addition to authenticating the user. And so basically, we're going to take the SharePoint app and raise it, you know, to a first-class security principle. Now, we also have authorization. You know, once we recognize a particular security principle and we've established the identity, well, then we're able to configure permissions, you know, for different principles so that some can access a resource and others are going to get access denied. Now, the first part of the story is that quite often the user still has to authenticate before the app can be authenticated. And so one of the things that's important is in this new SharePoint app model, we don't support the older style of web application, which is kind of what we call classic authentication, which only supports Windows, and it kind of leaves the identity of the user in just a Windows security token. We want to switch over to this claims model where users, whether they're authenticated via Windows, via Windows from a, you know, basically a ADFS 2.0, you know, SAML-based or FBA, everybody gets normalized into this one common type of security token that we think of as a claims token. You know, so a claims token is just an in-memory data structure that SharePoint will convert any type of identity to so it can understand it and track it within the particular farm. Okay, now, when we get to app authentication in SharePoint 2013, you know, some of the things that we're going to see is the web application that's hosting has to support claims auth. Obviously, up in Office 365, that's all there is, but just for on-premise farms, just make sure that anytime you try to push apps out, you know, that the hosting web application is, you know, using the new model that was introduced in SharePoint 2010. Okay, another very important thing to see is that when calls come into SharePoint, only calls that are routed through CSOM and REST endpoints go through this pipeline where SharePoint will even attempt to authenticate the app. So if you have an app and your app does something like gets a GET on a default.aspx page, that's not going through CSOM, that's not going through REST, you know, so there's no way it's going to be authenticated, you know, under this model we're going to look at. Okay, also, we can say there are three types of authentication. We're going to cover the first one, internal, and it's actually pretty easy to cover, and that's what's always used with SharePoint-hosted apps and your client-side code. But really kind of the meat of the session is when we start looking at the last two. External authentication basically means you have server-side code that's calling back into SharePoint, and we have the one that's created for the on-premises scenarios, you know, which is S2S trusts, and then we have the one that's designed to work up in the cloud with Office 365, which we know as OAuth. Now, let's start with internal authentication. Okay, now, if internal authentication is happening, we can say the following must be true. The app must be calling into SharePoint through a CSOM or REST API endpoint. The incoming call has to already have been authenticated with a user identity. You know, and basically there has to be a claims token for that particular user. And finally, the incoming call has to target the path of an app web. So whenever you create SharePoint hosted apps and it creates that app web, for each installed instance of an application, it creates that very funky looking unique URL. But what SharePoint is able to do is, if you have installed 17 apps, and we have 17 installed app instances, in the app management service, which is a new service application added to SharePoint 2013 to support apps, it's got a database behind it, and that's going to track mappings for each URL to an app web to an app identity. And so what SharePoint's able to do is basically just say, hey, here's an incoming call. It goes to this URL. Let's look it up. Oh, that's app instance number 13 that was installed, you know, previously. Now, here is what to remember about internal authentication. The best thing is it just works, and it doesn't really require any explicit programming on the part of the programmer. Okay. Now, it's always going to be used when we have client-side calls from pages inside of the app web. Now, you can use it in other cases. You can do tricky things, such as, let's say that I have a provider-hosted app, but for various reasons, I don't want to use server-side code to call back into SharePoint. I want to have client-side code on the pages of my remote web. Well, it can use something called the cross-domain library to basically call back into SharePoint, but it has to route through the app web so that we can have that internal authentication mechanism working properly for us. Okay. Now, one of the things to note is that when you have client-side code and you get this security model that just works, one important limitation is you can't use an app-only identity. And I'll talk a little bit more of that in just a couple of slides, but that gives me an inability to elevate my call above the permissions of the current user. So only server-side code and the two tougher authentication protocols, you know, support this idea of elevating above the privileges of the current user. Now, external authentication. We have two of our last sections that are going to drill into this, but let's just kind of look at it from a high level. So in which scenarios do we use external authentication? It's basically when you have your C# or VB.NET code running inside of the remote web and you want to call back to SharePoint. Now, remember, internal authentication, what we just talked about, always has to go through the app web. And even though you have to go through the app web, there's that little trick where I can call in through the app web but tell SharePoint, oh, it's the host web I'd like to program against. What's kind of nice about external authentication is you don't have to go through the app web. You go right to the source. Typically, it's going to be the host web, you know, but it could be any site your app has permissions to be able to access. Now, how does it work? We have to write code that creates or retrieves and manages access tokens. So instead of having the internal authentication where the user is authenticated and then we basically get the app identity from the incoming URL, instead, your server-side code has to create the security token, known as an access token, that has the app identity, and it has the, in most cases, the user identity as well. And so when we call into SharePoint, SharePoint's able to go through the process to authenticate the app as a first-class security principle. And once we do that, you know, we're able to basically configure permissions for the particular app. Now, here's a slide that, it's a popular slide, Rob Howard. as far as security goes, Rob Howard, Steve Peshka, they're the two guys up on the hill that we all bow down to. But Rob started showing this slide a ways back, but I think it's just an important thing for everyone to make sure that they understand how things work. So a call comes into SharePoint. Now, what's going to happen is there's going to be this process of questions that SharePoint asks to determine whether it needs to authenticate the app in this incoming call. So the first thing that we say is, does it target a CSOM or REST endpoint? And if the answer is no, we're never going to have app authentication. It just does basic user authentication and sets up the calling context as the user, and any resource that that user has permissions to, you know, is going to be accessible. Okay, now if it does hit a CSOM or REST endpoint, okay, the next thing we ask is, has the user already been authenticated, or does it have a claims token? And if the answer to that question is yes, well then the next question is, does the URL target a known app web URL? If so, well then we're basically just going to authenticate as the app And SharePoint is able to set up the calling context under the identity of both the user and the app. Okay. And if we target a CSOM or REST endpoint and we have a claims token, but we're just going to a regular SharePoint site, once again, we just have standard user authentication. You know, as you're seeing all this stuff with CSOM and you're getting the app authentication, one fallback is to say, forget about the app identity. I'm going to create some kind of server-side infrastructure that's going to call into SharePoint just as the current user. You know, so that's always available to us, and I wouldn't overuse it, you know, but it is a scenario that I see more and more people going to because of some of the issues that we're going to see along the way or some of the costs and hurdles that you have to come to get the external authentication working. Okay, now, what happens if SharePoint looks in and doesn't see a user identity with a claims token? The next thing it says is, do you have an access token? And if there's no access token, there's no authentication, and if we don't support anonymous access, which is very unlikely, there's just an access denied error that goes back. However, if there is an access token, the SharePoint app authentication pipeline is going to look in there, and if it is a valid access token, there is always going to be an app identity inside there. And more often than not, there will also be a user identity inside there. Now, when I say app and user identity, the two things come together. And one of the things that Sesha pointed out to me that I think is really important to point out is, while you have an user identity, it's constrained by what the app can do. So you can never use it to create a standalone user identity and do something with it. However, when the call comes in, if it looks at this access token and says, oh, there's a app identity, there's a user identity, it then sets up the call context with both. If your server-side code has decided to create an access token known as an app-only access token, it only sets up the call context with the app identity. Why do we like app identity? So without app-only identity, you have a call that's running as both the app and the user. The authorization model says that both the app needs permission and the user needs permission to be able to do something. And if one has it but not the other, the call fails. So what's app-only access tokens all about? It's about losing the identity of the current user, only running under the identity of the app in case that current user didn't have much privilege. And now the app can do whatever the app has been, you know, granted is, you know, in terms of permissions. Okay, now, next thing we're going to do is talk about app permissions. Now, I told you there was three types of app authentication. There's internal that just works, and there's two types of external authentication, S2S and OAuth, that are going to be harder to explain. But the app permission model works the same way across all three. It doesn't change what I'm going to tell you here. So I'm going to quickly go through, you know, how app permissions are configured, and just realize that after we get to the end, this story doesn't change at all. Now, app permissions, you know, have to be granted. Now, many of us have worked with SharePoint for several different versions, and we're very familiar with how user permissions are configured. For instance, I could just put an access control list on the top level site, and then everything down below, all these other securable objects that don't have their own access control lists, well, access to them is dictated by the first access control list up. So there's this hierarchy of securable objects. Now, what would be a mistake is for you to say, I know everything about user permission configuration, therefore I must know something about app permission configuration. You know nothing. The models are completely different. Okay. Now, most user permissions, you know, everything in a site is stored in a content database behind a site collection. But it wasn't quite that easy as they started working with apps, because you can give an app permission at tenancy scope, and so that's going to span multiple site collections, possible multiple content databases. You know, so the way that permissions get tracked are very, very different, and some get tracked in the database behind the app management service. Now, what you're going to see is that the app permission model is brand new. The user permission model is much older, arguably more mature because we have so much more granularity. So the app permission model we have right now, you know, our first comment after learning is, God, I wish it was more granular. And I think that's just kind of something that's going to keep evolving over time. Now, let's say that your app needs to do some things that it doesn't have permissions to. It asks for permissions 1, 2, and 3. So what we're going to see is that inside the app manifest, there are going to be permission requests. And when someone installs an app, that installer gets prompted to trust the app or not trust the app. If you trust the app gets installed, permissions get configured. If you decide not to trust the app, it doesn't get installed. So if an app says, I want permissions 1, 2, and 3, you can't say, I want to give you 1 and 3, but I'm not going to give you 2. It's an all or nothing proposition, which is actually good for us developers because then we can always make the assumption that if we've been installed, we have the permissions that we asked for inside of the app manifest. Now, there's also a couple things about default permissions. So there are certain times your app doesn't need to request explicit permissions because it already has them. So remember, the app has full control over the app web. Obviously, when SharePoint posts to the start page and passes you query string parameters, you have access to all those. And you basically have, you know, very little to no permissions on the host web. So typically, we want to have server-side C# code inside of our remote web. We want to call back into the host web and check out what lists are there, create lists, create content types, you know, all kinds of things inside there. So we're going to have to request permissions that someone has to grant during the installation of the app. Now, I'm going to do a quick demo and kind of walk through how permissions work inside there. So I'm going to go ahead and switch over to my demo machine here. Actually, if I want to be official, I should go up to the demo slide. Note that what I'm showing you here is that within Visual Studio, you're able to access the raw XML for the app manifest.xml file, make edits there. You can also use the Visual Designer. When you start working with permissions, the Visual Designer is definitely your friend because you don't have to remember, you know, the scopes. They're kind of built in, and we, you know, get a much easier way to do things inside there. Also note that there is an allow app only policy attribute, and that thing has to be set to true if you plan on using app only policy because you want to create an app only token. Realize that this attribute is totally meaningless in a SharePoint hosted app because they can't do the elevation, you know, through creating an app only token. It's only server side code, you know, running in the remote web that has that capability. Now, what you're going to see is that app permission requests have this scope that tells us about a particular product, and most of the time we're going to see SharePoint, you know, but as we move forward and do more and more with Office 365, it could be Exchange, it could be Link. And then there's this idea of the permission provider. And so there's the general SharePoint Foundation content permission provider. So we can set permissions on things like lists and sites. And then there is a target object. So each permission provider has a defined set of target objects I can define. And then we have different rights. Okay, I'll do a little bit more when we get into the demo in just a second. And then once we have those permission requests, when someone installs the app, the installer is going to be prompted. One other thing to remember is that you can't install an app if it asks for a permission that you do not have. So one of the things that you could do is you could say, I want my app to be all powerful. I want it full control over the tenancy. And then you've made it so someone who's a site collection owner but doesn't have any tenancy level permissions can't install your app. You know, so there's this idea of don't be overreaching as you add permissions, because it's going to reduce the number of people who could potentially install your app. Okay, so finally now we get to this demo slide. Love those green bars. Okay, so let's go back over here. I've got this test site right here. And so what I wanted to do is kind of put things into, you know, very basic terms right here. So I have a SharePoint hosted app. And so I have a button. And when someone clicks the button, what we're going to try to do is we're going to try to make a call to the app web. I'm not sure if you've seen this in the session, but, you know, as we write client-side JavaScript code and we have to route through the app web, I still might want to actually program against the host web, and here's the way you do it. You basically have the SP app context site. You put that inside there. And so now we're just going to make a simple AJAX request, and if it comes back successfully, we're just going to print out the site title. And if it comes back and fails, this is going to execute right here. Let's go ahead and run this right here. So I'm going to go ahead and run this. And so the basic premise of this demo is that this app at first is going to make a call to the host web, and it does not have permissions to do what it's attempting to do. So what you'll see is that there's a very confusing flow for the user. They bring up this right here. And what we should have in big text is, your current credentials don't have permissions. Pull those administrator credentials out of your back pocket and put in a second one. But most users just think, I need to log in again. They keep putting in their username and password, and they get the exact same thing. And after three times, what's going to happen is finally come back and give you an access denied error. So, you know, here's a common example of, here's my JavaScript code. When the error thing flies out, I basically look at the status. If that's a 401, that's the access denied error. If it's some other error, you know, I'll basically just kind of print out the, you know, what's in the context of the error information. So what we want to be able to do is fix this. So we're going to basically go back to the app manifest, and I'll open the app manifest and kind of take a look at, we have no permission request right now. Now, I'll also double click on this guy right here to open this up. And in our case right here, if I go to permissions and I come down here, and what do I want? Well, I want to get a permission on my host web. And in this case right here, you know, I might ask for read permission. So basically, I could rerun this and it would work fine. Let's go a little bit further here. And let's say that I want some other permissions to something else. You know, for instance, I want to use managed metadata and use the CSOM interfaces to basically look at a term set. Well, I could use this inside here. And so note that there are these standard permissions, which are read, write, manage, and full control. And as much as possible, Microsoft has tried to get the teams that are making those permission providers to stick with these four basic rights. But what you'll find is that there are some cases, you know, such as search, you know, where none of those permissions made sense. You know, so this permission provider had to create its own kind of one-off right to be able to configure. Now, let's say that inside of this particular, let's say that maybe I wanted to read the entire site collection right here. You know, so I'll say I want to be able to read at the site collection level. But now at the web level, I'd like to do something else. You know, maybe I'd like to have write capabilities. Now, remember that write capabilities will give you the permission to be able to add a list item or upload a document, but not to create a list or create a document library. You know, so you might bounce it up higher. Now, let's say that I just want lists right here. And so I want to be able to manage lists so I can create lists. So what you're going to see is that this is nowhere near as granular as you can configure permissions, you know, inside of user permissions, where you can go right down to the item level and configure that for a particular user or a particular Active Directory group. So we do have a little bit of granularity here. So if I come down and I say edit, and I have this dialog inside here, and I'll say something like base template ID, and base template ID is going to equal 101. So what I'm basically saying is I don't want permissions to create any type of list, just with the one with the type ID of 101, which is document library. Okay. If I come back here and we take a look at, you know, what just happened right here, you know, you can see that all of these are using the SharePoint product. But now, you know, in addition to the content provider, we have the search permission provider, the taxonomy permission provider. I have this base template ID. And so I wish there was a good resource that would have, you know, published each one of these that's available. You know, so these are kind of blind. There's no IntelliSense. You have to type those in. But I think this is where we're going to see over time getting the granularity is by adding, you know, these different types of properties inside. Let's go ahead and start the app, and I can kind of simulate what's going to happen with a real-world installation of the app. And that is, as it starts installing the app right here, it's going to, at some point, prompt me with this particular page. So SharePoint kind of does the best it can to explain to the installer what permissions are being given away. Let it read items in the site collection. Let it edit and delete documents and list items in the site. Let it approve items in the list. And now it's just showing me all the document libraries. You know, what you have to understand is that if we create a document library tomorrow, the app has permissions on that as well. Now, I'll go ahead and say trust it. And so now the app has been installed. It's been configured with permissions. You know, as it tries to make the call in, it's successful inside there. If I go back here and I'm taking a look at Fiddler and we make that call one more time and we come back and we take a look at that, I can look to authorization. You know, so basically that's evidence that there's user authentication, there's a claims token associated with it, and then, you know, by virtue of the fact that we were routing in through this specific URL, SharePoint was able to identify which app instance which has been installed that maps to, so it sets up the call context with the user and the app identity inside. Okay, so that was just a quick look at, you know, how our app permissions work. Now, next thing we're going to do is move to external authentication. And remember, there's two types. There's the one that's used exclusively on-premises, which is S2S trusts, and then there's the one that's always used up in Office 365, and can be used in on-premises installations, which is basically OAuth. Now, there's a set of concepts that apply no matter which one of those I'm using, and that's what we're going to cover first. There's this idea of the app security principle. Now, what you might not know and what you probably don't have to care about is when you install a SharePoint hosted app and it creates that URL that maps to it, you know, it creates basically a GUID for that app identity, but it's all done behind the scenes and it doesn't require your attention. However, when we start making calls that use external authentication, we require an app security principle to be created, and in many cases, it's going to require us to explicitly register one of these app security principles before we start using it. So, what is an app principle? Or an app security principle. Basically, it's a GUID that identifies a particular app identity. And it is going to be tenancy scoped. Now, probably should have gone a little bit more into tenancies at the beginning. But when we talk about tenancies, back in SharePoint 2003 and 2007, and for most of us in 2010, we never talked about tenancies. It was an Office 365 thing. The basic reason that we need tenancies is in on-premises, our IT staff configures things at the farm level and the web application level. Okay. In Office 365, you got one big farm, one big web application, so no customer is going to get access at the farm or web application level. And if the model basically said you have access at the site collection level, well, then there's no collective way to kind of manage things across, you know, two or more site collections. So pretty early on in the hosted version of SharePoint, they came up with this concept of a tenancy, which is simply a collection of site collections that all belong to one customer that we want to track and manage as a unit. And up in Office 365, every tenancy has a tenant admin site collection, and I configure tenant admin permissions for you. You can get up to the tenant admin site collection and create more site collections and configure all kinds of things. So when they created the app model, there had to be the scope at which everything got installed, and so they picked tenancy. And now when we get back to the on-premises farms, we don't think in terms of tenancies, you know, unless you're one of those crazy people who wants to kind of get the multi-tenant environment going in an on-premises farm. So what we have to do is we have to create and configure something which is called the site settings service. And that's what they use up in Office 365 to manage tenancies. But you can run basically a small PowerShell script, very easy to find on the internet, that will create this service application and create a default farm-wide tenancy. You know, so even though we don't think in terms of tenancies, when we think about apps, we have to think in terms of tenancies. And we, in most cases, just have a single farm-wide default tenancy inside there. Okay, now, here are the properties of an app principle. You have a client ID, which is just the GUID. Now, I also have to mention that as all this came together, there was things like the OAuth spec, and there was other technologies, and we had this kind of clash of terminology. So you'll see client ID, and then someone will talk about an app ID. It's the exact same thing. You know, so in your head, client ID, and unfortunately, places in SharePoint and documentation keep jumping back and forth between client ID and app ID. Just always make sure you know it's the same thing. If we're using OAuth and not S2S, we're going to need a client secret or app secret. And the idea of that is it's used as a encryption key. It's a shared secret between various parties that they can use to communicate in a secure fashion. You have the app host domain. What's that all about? Well, when you install an app, you have to, if it's a provider-hosted app, before you install it, you already have to have the remote web stood up and available somewhere on the local network or out on the internet. And so when you register an app principal, you have to tell SharePoint, this is where my app lives. When calls come in, only if they come from this URL, from this base domain, will it be a valid call. Also note that everything up in Office 365 is HTTPS. Many of us on premises, some of us have gone to HTTPS, some haven't. You know, but what you'll see is that if you don't use HTTPS, you can't really, you know, get the guarantee that the caller is really coming from the URL that it looks like. So it's just there's a very high recommendation to use HTTPS throughout, you know, whenever you're standing up a remote web. In fact, you have to flick a switch to allow HTTP instead of HTTPS as you're working in an on-premises farm. The last thing that you can create is something called a redirect URL, which is for an advanced scenario where we want to basically elevate permission on demand. Okay, and we're going to concentrate basically on the first three inside there. Now, how do you manage the app principles? So there are some built-in pages, and we're going to take a quick look at those right here. And you can use those. Unfortunately, they're not linked to, so you're going to have to type in the URLs to be able to get to these pages. There's also PowerShell. If you're in an on-premises farm, you can basically just use the PowerShell commandlets that are built into SharePoint 2013 to be able to create and manage your app principles. If you're up in Office 365, there is a remote PowerShell story and commandlets where you can basically do the same thing against your Office 365 tenancies. Now, there is this app reg new page. And the idea is that you can just go up to a site collection and type in this URL, and you're going to add the app ID, aka client ID. You can add the app secret. You can add the app title. You have to add the app domain. And it's not required unless you're kind of using that elevate on demand scenario, but you can also add a redirect URL inside there. Okay, now, once you create that, you definitely want to record that information because now we have a particular GUID, and several parties are going to have to know about that ahead of time. Okay. There's also a app inventory page, and if you go to this with no query string parameters, what you can do is you can put a GUID into that app ID checkbox and click lookup, and if you do that, if it finds a registered app principal, basically it will pull you and show you that. If the app has any configured permissions, you might see those loaded into the box down below. And then there's another one called app principals, which allows you to see the app principals that are already registered on the system. Okay, so just kind of giving you a quick look at how all this is going to work. When I see the green bars, I know it's safe to switch over here. Let's go back to our site right here. And if we have underscore layouts 15, and I basically just type this inside there, app reg new.aspx. I can basically pull back this one built-in application page, works on-premises, works great up in Office 365, and either you bring a GUID to the party or you just tell it, hey, generate a GUID for me. There's the app secret. So when you're registering up in Office 365, or if you're registering on-premises and you know you're using OAuth, not S2S, you can create one of these. There's the title, my app, and then there's going to be the app domain, www.myappweb.com, something like that. And then once again, as I mentioned, you don't need to put the redirect URL inside there. So let's go ahead and choose create. And now what you can see is that thing has been created inside there. Let me go ahead and grab this identifying GUID. And if I go ahead and choose copy, and now we go back to the app inventory and choose OK. Something went wrong because my spelling is not as good as it should be. Okay, but now I come down here. I want to see if that thing has been registered. We pull that back, and you can basically, you know, see that you've already got something registered inside there. Okay, now we're finally at the point where we can get into the two things you probably came for, which is understanding S2S and understanding OAuth. So our next topic is going to look at what I think is the easier one to understand. Could be the more frustrating one that makes you pull your hair out more, but it has fewer concepts, so I decided to kind of cover S2S before we go into OAuth. So what is a server-to-server or S2S trust? It's basically a trusted connection between your app, or more specifically, the server-side code running in your remote web and a SharePoint host. And so it's based on SSL certificates. And the idea is that an SSL certificate has a public-private key pair. And if I have the private key and I don't share it with anyone else, and you and anyone else in the world can have the public key, the idea is that I could take a message, sign it with the private key, send it to you. You could basically use the public key to decrypt it and read it, and you basically get the guarantee that I generated the message, or I was lame and somebody stole the private key and was able to kind of spoof me inside there. You know, so the whole model is based on not letting the private key get into the hands of the bad guy. Now, what's the requirement? You're going to have the private key accessible to code that's running inside your remote web. It's going to need to be able to get that private key because it's going to be creating access tokens and using it, you know, to basically sign and make it so that it can be validated over on the other side. Then, in addition to that, you also have to create a special component on the SharePoint farm, which is going to act as a security token service. And we'll see that in just a second, and I'm going to show you how to do that with PowerShell. Now, this is what is referred to as a high-trust app. Now, first of all, let's differentiate between high-trust and full-trust. Full-trust is you being naughty and calling SP Security run with elevated privileges and doing whatever the heck you want to. That is not what we have here. High-trust, the app still has to have permissions to do anything. So we're not just giving the app a blank check to go do what it wants. But what we have in this model is that the app is going to authenticate the user. It's going to establish the user identity, constrained by the app identity, inside of an access token, send it over to SharePoint, and we call it high trust because we really have to believe that that remote web is an honest guy and it's not going to lie to us about who the particular user is. Okay. Now, the architecture of an S2S trust is that you have an SSL or an X509 certificate that has the public-private key pair. The public key has to be registered with the SharePoint farm, and that's what we're going to show with PowerShell in just a second, to create a trusted security token issuer. The app is then going to create access tokens by using a class that's added to your provider and auto-hosted projects, which is called the Token Helper class. And it's going to create access tokens and pass them in a header when it makes calls in using CSOM or REST. And what's going to happen is that the SharePoint host is going to be able to see that access token. It's going to be able to validate it because it's got the public key. And then it's going to be able to take the app identity and possibly user identity or possibly it's app only and set up the call context. Okay, now, as far as the steps to configure, well, the first thing we have to do is create or obtain an X509 certificate. In the development environment, for my demo, we're just going to use PowerShell and create, you know, a weaker certificate, a self-signed certificate, which is going to be fine for development. Once we get into production, we want to, you know, in most cases go down the road of getting, you know, professional grade SSL certificates, you know, which requires installation, you know, by our IT staff. You know, so that's definitely part of the overhead you should count on early on. Make sure that you have, you know, the red tape cleared out of the way, you know, so that people are going to be able to configure your environment. You don't want to work for 9 months in your dev environment with a self-signed certificate. Time to roll out the app. Oh yeah, it's going to take you 6 months to get the certificates in place right here. You know, so kind of work on that stuff early, just because, from my experience, it's always been a lot of red tape in getting those things working. Okay, now we're going to use PowerShell to create this thing that understands the public-private key pair, which is called a trusted security token issuer. Now, over in the remote web, we have to provide access to the private key. We're going to create access tokens with the help of this class called the Token Helper class, and then we're just going to pass that when we make CSOM and REST API calls. Now, there's two ways to make the certificate, or at least the public key of the certificate, available to SharePoint. What you're going to typically do in a developer environment is you're going to have the public key, you're going to have a PowerShell script, you're going to run the PowerShell script, you're going to call a commandlet, and you're just going to take that file and create an object with PowerShell to pass into SharePoint so I can create that. If you're creating a more polished application, there's also a way for your app to have a metadata endpoint. So when you call that SharePoint commandlet, instead of pointing it to, you know, a local file, you can point it to an endpoint, and SharePoint will basically call in and discover what the public key is from that, you know, as it's creating the trusted security token issuer. Now, here's some code. You can't really see that code. I think I'm going to wait to the demo because I'm going to show you the exact same code inside there. But we're going to run a first PowerShell script to create their certificate files. Second, we're going to run a PowerShell script that's going to create the secure token issuer. Okay. Now, I'm not going to do this as part of the demo, but you could also add additional PowerShell to create the app principal. So if you wanted to kind of do all the management, you know, of creating the security token issuer, and then creating one or more app principles that map to that, you know, it can all be done with PowerShell. It's probably what you want to do before you push it out, you know, into a production environment. Okay, now, next demo that we have is going to do just that. So let me go back here. And back here, I'm going to go into my demos. And we have an S to S configuration. And so let's go ahead and look at this right here. I'm going to go ahead and open up this PowerShell script. At the same time, I also want to show IIS and make some points about how things are being configured inside here. And before I do anything here, what I want to do is in IIS, click on this top level node for the server. And then I can come down here to server certificates. And, you know, one of the things that I wanted to show you is that we don't have anything in here yet. After I run the PowerShell script, we are. Okay, now, let's go back over here. Let me make this much bigger so you can actually see it. So, first of all, there are these two utilities that we get when we install SharePoint. Nothing special. These things have been around for a while. There's the make cert.exe utility. And that one can be used to create a self-signed certificate, which will give you everything you need to be able to do this in a development slash testing environment. There's also a second utility called Cert Manager, and this one is going to be used to actually take the certificate after it's been created and register it with IIS. I'll kind of explain why that is along the way. Now, let's go ahead and run this right here. I'm going to go ahead and run this, and after I run this, what I want you to see is that it created a folder name, certs, and inside there, it created two different files. So the .cer file is the one that has the public key. Now, optionally, when you create a .cer file with make cert, you can add an instruction in here to say, oh, and also embed the private key inside there. We're going to have to get the private key somewhere. Some way, and this is just, you know, a easy technique to do that. Secondly, we're going to take that CR file and register it with IIS. So if I come back here and I go off and back, and now we look inside here, you know, what we should be able to see is that there's the thing that just got registered. So notice that when I created this right here, I put the certificate name inside, or the subject name is appserver.wingtip.com. Now, one of the extra things that you could do with this that I'm not going to do in this demo is then I could set up my remote web to basically run it https://appserver.wingtip.com. Okay. Now, the real reason I've installed this thing in IIS is I have a CER file that has a public key and also the private key. And so what IIS does is it provides this kind of neat functionality where I could say I would like to export that, and I would like to export this to a particular file, my private key. And what's going to happen is that you can export this to create what's called a PFX file that has the private key inside there. But now remember, if the bad guy gets the private key, the game's over. So the whole idea of the PFX file is we put this additional security constraint on there where it's password protected. So ultimately, you're going to have to know the password and have the PFX file to be able to extract the private key inside there. And the reason that I've installed things in IIS is that you don't have to, you know, actually do anything manually. You just basically run this script right here. And then there's some code down below that goes into IIS. It looks at the certificates, find the one that we just installed, and basically, you know, does the export to a PFX file. And I've just kind of created the password as password one right there. Okay, so that's step one. Now, step two is going to be to run a PowerShell script that's going to create one of these things, which is called a Trusted Security Token Issuer. Okay, now, first of all, we need a GUID to identify this guy, and that's going to be called the Issuer ID. I wanted to get a really easy GUID to keep things straight. Can you imagine how many times I had to click Generate GUID in GUID view to get this right here? Okay, yeah. That's a sympathy laugh at best. Thank you. Okay. So now the next thing we need to do is we need to get the authentication realm. Once again, we have the collision of two different terminologies. Whenever you say realm, it means tenancy. So what we really need is the GUID for the tenancy. And so this code right here says get a SP site object for a particular site collection. And it really could be any site collection in the farm, because then when I call get authentication realm and I pass that particular site, it just gives me back the GUID for the hosting tenancy, which will be a single GUID for your entire farm. Now, we have to create this thing called the registered issuer name. So your issuer has an ID, but since it's being installed in the context of a specific tenancy, we have to create this registered issuer name that has the GUID of the issuer, and then an at sign, and then the GUID of the hosting tenancy. Now, here's some code to take that CR file. Remember that CR file has the public key inside? You know, so here's a way to basically get it as a object. And now when I call new SP Trusted Security Token Issuer, I pass that GUID with all the ones. I pass the GUID with all the ones parsed together with the GUID of the tenancy. And then I pass this object, which basically gives it the public key that it can go ahead and use. Now, I want to point out that there was a big change right at the end of the beta cycle, just before they went RTM. And throughout most of the beta cycle of SharePoint 2013, you use the same GUID for the app principal and for the token issuer, which meant that for every single app principal, you could basically, you had to have, you know, a certificate map one-to-one. And there was enough feedback saying, well, can I create three app principals but only deal with one certificate? So what we can do, and typically what I will always do, is say is trust broker, which basically means that the app principal GUID can be different, and now I can have many app principals that all map to this one certificate that's been installed. Okay. The other thing I'm going to do here is I'm going to say, oh, and by the way, I'm just doing development. I don't want to install and get HTTPS worked out, so you can relax the requirement of using HTTPS by doing this, which is basically going to do some configuration on that component that we just made to allow HTTP. Okay, let's go ahead and run this right here. We go ahead and we run this particular script, And after this script runs, one of the things that I wanted to do with this script right here is, after running it, to basically just spit out a text file. Because remember, you know, as you're using this, you know, you're going to need things like that particular GUID, you know, which has all ones inside there. So for a little bit later, I'm just going to copy that, put that into the clipboard. Okay. So at this point, things are registered inside there, and now we're kind of ready to get to the next step. Okay. Now, what is the next step? The next step is developing apps that use S2S trusts. So first of all, what is the developer responsible for? The developer is responsible for making sure that the remote web authenticates the user. So let's get bad news first. When we look at S2S and we compare it to OAuth, OAuth has this wonderful quality where SharePoint authenticates the user and we don't have to in the remote web. When you're using OAuth, typically your remote web just runs under anonymous access. When we use S2S, SharePoint is going to authenticate the user. Your remote web has to independently authenticate the user, and you both have to agree on some string that identifies that particular user. And so when we're using the most straightforward case of Windows Auth, works out pretty well. As you get into cases where we have ADFS and FBA, things get a little bit more complicated. But as Sesha pointed out, we have to make sure that as SharePoint and the remote web authenticates, they're basically authenticating against the same master, whether it's an Active Directory or some other identity repository, so that they kind of agree on who that particular user is. Okay, now, we're going to create access tokens with the assistance of this class, which is the Token Helper class. And then, after we've done that, we're going to find various ways to create access tokens and attach them to every CSOM and REST call by adding an authorization header and basically adding the access token in a special format inside there. Okay. Now, S2S tokens, you could say S2S and OAuth are different, but their common ground is that they both use the OAuth spec for creating the access token. You know, so you really do have a common format. When we get to OAuth, we're going to see there's a lot of things bouncing back and forth. What's kind of nice about S2S is that, you know, you're the man or you're the woman. You basically have the private key and you just create the access tokens and they're good to go. You don't have to go to any other party. It's kind of like you have a printing press to create money whenever you want. It's going to be very different, you know, when we get into OAuth inside there. Now, the security token is always going to contain the app identity, and optionally it can contain the user identity, or you can have an app-only access token. And then the security token has to be signed with the private key of the SSL certificate, which largely just happens behind the scenes when you use the Token Helper class. Now, here's an example. When you look at the Token Helper class, you're going to say, I'm using S2S, boy, I wish I was using OAuth. There are a large number of things, you know, inside that are created for OAuth, so there has to be a little due diligence on your part, you know, knowing which of the methods, you know, can be used with S2S. There's three that have get S2S in its title. So get S2S client context with Windows identity, get S2S access token with Windows identity. So here's a very simple example, pretty much the one that they add to your code when you create a S2S trusted application. They call get S2S client context with Windows identity. You have a client context, you do CSOM programming as usual, and they just automatically add the header the right way inside there. Okay. Now, there was this last bullet point I quickly glossed over, saying that you might have to extend the Token Helper class for various scenarios. So let me address that after the demo. So let's say that I want to do something inside here. So remember in my previous demo, one of the things that I did was to basically create that PFX file, and also I was able to register the security token issuer. So now we'll go ahead and we'll use Visual Studio, and we're going to say I want to create a new project, and what type of project do I want? I want a SharePoint app inside here. So this is my provider-hosted app. So I'm using Visual Studio 2013. If you've used it in 2012, you notice that the user interface experience is going to be a little bit different here. But I pick provider hosted app, and then I get to this page, which you don't see in Visual Studio 2012. If you want to use web forms or MVC, just because MVC is probably new to some of you, let's kind of stick with the thing everybody knows, just because that's not the thing we're talking about here. So I'll just pick web forms inside. And then we get to this right here. If it was up to me, I would have said top button equals OAuth in Office 365. Bottom is S2S in an on-premises scenario. So I'm going to say user certificate. And so now what I'm able to do is on my local development machine, point to the PFX file. I then need to give it the password. Once I've given it the password, now I need the security token issuer ID. And I'm going to go ahead and choose finish. Now, when I've done that, you know what we're going to see is that we have this app right here. And if I go kind of take a look at what they've done, they basically put some Hello World code inside there, you know, basically so I can just hit F5. And if I've got all my kinks worked out with the S2S configuration, it's just going to work and basically show me an Hello World call inside there. Let's look at another thing down here. Let's look at the web.config file. And when I look at the web.config file, I have a client signing certificate path. I have the password, I have the issuer ID, and so really all I need is the client ID. Also, now that this is what's over in the remote web, let's go back up to the top project and see the app manifest. And if I say view code inside here, I have the client ID. So now, typically what I do is I go create an app security principal, and I'd make sure I know where the domain was that the remote web stood up at, and basically I'd create the app security principal, I'd put that GUID in both places, and we'd be good to go. Okay, now here's where Visual Studio is your friend. What if I don't change this at all? I just leave it at client ID equals star. Visual Studio will say, okay, Ted, you're a lazy son of a gun. What I'm going to do for you is when you hit the F5 key, I will go ahead and register on the fly an app security principal for you. So it just creates the GUID. It basically knows where your remote web is going to be stood up, somewhere in localhost. But it basically does the registration when you hit the F5 key, and when you stop your debugging session, it basically rips it out. So what that means is I should just be able to hit the F5 key right here. And if I hit the F5 key, and we go and we look at this web.config file, it's telling me you haven't done this before, you're going through HTTPS with localhost, so Visual Studio registers that certificate for me. But now it's saying, hey, some outside party has just updated the web.config file. Would you like to reload it? And what you're going to see right here is that on the fly, it created this GUID right here and registered that as an app security principal on my behalf. So now that we have done that, do you trust the app? I do trust the app. It then calls to the app. And what Visual Studio has done is kind of put some Hello World code inside there. Let's come back up here, and if I run this one more time, and the same thing happens again, let's take a look back here, and you can see that, hey, here is a CSOM call that was made from the remote web back over to SharePoint, hey, and there's our access token. So the way things work is that you have to have a header named authorization, and then you have the word bearer, a space, and then the access token string goes inside there. And so basically, that's how things work. When I use CSOM, the whole act of taking the access token and attaching it just happens transparently behind the scenes. When you do REST programming with C#, God help you if that's your thing, but if you're doing that, you're going to have to attach it explicitly. I'm going to wait till a little bit later while I'll show you an example of doing that once we get to OAuth. Okay, let's go ahead and go a little bit further here, because my guess is that Hello World sample was not overly satisfying. So let's kind of do some real world stuff right here. So in our case right here, I am going to open project. I'm going to go to this server-side CSOM. I just have a demo that we use in one of our app development courses, A Critical Path. So what I have here, is things set up with, a client ID inside there, or in our case right here, if I take a look at this, let me get this thing inside here just so you can see it, view code. So if all your projects just have star here, on your dev box, you don't have to worry about constantly registering app security principles. It just kind of happens transparently behind the scenes, which most of us kind of get used to. And the fact that the app ID or the web config has the GUID from last time, it's probably going to be switched out, and things are just going to work inside there. So what I wanted to show here, is just some examples of what we can do with our server-side code. And it's telling me that I don't have a URL yet. So let me take my project and put it to a particular site collection. And so go ahead and hit the F5 key, and you see that, it's changing, adding a different GUID because it just registered something else. We have this inside here. And so I just kind of wanted to show some simple examples here. Let's go back and take a look at some code that we have. And as I look at this code right here, in all my examples, I'm just going to be using CSOM, but on this first one right here, what I'm going to be doing is simply going through and making a call with CSOM, getting information back. But come back here, let's go ahead, click that, make the call inside here. And as I make the call and come back, what we should be able to verify, each time when I go back here and take a look at the calls, that each one is going to have that access token set to it. Just to show some gratuitous code that maybe not necessarily has to do with CSOM or REST. Here's something where we want to figure out what lists you have in the particular site. So we'll go ahead and click on this guy right here. Here are all the different lists. Oh, but I don't want those hidden lists. Let's go ahead and get rid of those. So here's just kind of an example of having a far more efficient CSOM call, where when I call across the network, I'm able to use Lambda expressions to basically say, when you bring back the lists, make sure that you don't give me the hidden ones and don't bring every single column in the world back for those list properties. Only give me title in view right here. And so, one of the things that I want to show with this is there's get one, there's get two. And then if I, take a look back here at the difference between those two calls right here, and remember that everything that comes back is going to be in terms of JSON. And the inefficient one just basically says, give me everything in the world. And the more efficient one says, only give me the things that I want. So we're really kind of reducing the footprint or the amount of content that's going back and forth across the network. And then, of course, the final one I want to show right here is I want to be able to create a list. And so here's just kind of an example of using CSOM to create a list inside of the host web right here. And if you've used CSOM in previous versions, there's nothing special about it, other than now we're kind of passing the access token. But also, there's this issue where we now have these event remote receivers. And you've seen probably demos, maybe you've used them yourself, but there's this ugly rub where you can only hook up remote event receivers declaratively to stuff in the app web, which typically no one cares about. What we really want is to have a list in the host web and have the remote event receiver there, and you have to do that work programmatically. So here is an example where my remote web has exposed this endpoint right here under services, which is announcements, remote event receiver. I have some code in here, and I'll show you that code in just a second, but this other code right here is going to basically create the list, add a couple items to it, and hook up some remote event receivers. So now I come back here and I take a look at what we have just created, which is this announcements list. and so all the calls came in, I've created the list, create a couple items inside there. And if I have this remote event receiver, every time that we update the list, we're telling SharePoint to do various things inside there, but it's going to have the SharePoint host call back out into my remote web through this entry point right here. And let's say that, you know, I want a new announcement, and the new announcement is I love Google, and we'll go ahead and we'll try to go ahead and save that. Title cannot have inflammatory terms such as Google, Apple, or Netscape right here. So I love SharePoint inside here, and I guess I should spell SharePoint correctly, but as I go ahead and save this right here, what I want you to see is it got bounced to uppercase, and that's because one of the neat things that you could do is to have a event receiver that has a before event handler that not only does validation, but can also take things like a property, the title, and bounce it to uppercase. So the way that the remote event receiver works is that when someone does something in SharePoint, the SharePoint host knows to call to your entry point inside the remote web. Meanwhile, the user is just basically blocked waiting for your call to return. And what's neat there is you don't have to make inbound calls to do anything. They call you, you basically take data and massage it and you pass it back, and that gets to be kind of a neater scheme. In this way, I can actually say that remote event handling is more straightforward than the old server-side event handling, where it wasn't quite so straightforward to be able to massage something because you were supposed to do it in an after event, not a before event. Okay, so let's keep going here. So next thing we're going to look at is looking at OAuth. Now, actually, before I go, I know that there are some issues with S2S, where the token helper class works great with real simple scenarios, but as you move out into SAML-based scenarios into FBA, it doesn't work and you have to, you know, do some extending, you have to start writing security code. How many people are in that boat where, okay, so what I want to ask you guys is after the session to come up and talk to session me, because there's some very detailed stuff that is just not going to fit inside the session, but we're happy to kind of spend some time with you talking about that, gather around afterwards. Okay, now the last thing we're going to look at is OAuth. Now, OAuth is an industry standard. There's kind of a backstory where they created OAuth 1.0, and OAuth 1.0 was kind of something that it wanted to take over the identity management system. And various vendors said, we want to use it with existing identity management systems. So they created OAuth 2.0. The guy that created OAuth 1.0 said, you guys are crazy, and walked away. But you know, we use OAuth 2.0 in SharePoint, and it's just a very widely used protocol on the internet. Google, Facebook, you know, lots of things are using OAuth 2.0. And I think you'll still see some OAuth 1.0 out there, but that's not our concern. Now, how does it work? Incoming calls, just like S2S, are going to require an access token. Okay, the access token can have the user identity in addition to the app identity, or we can go with an app-only access token. Calls do not need to target the app web. So one of the nice things is that you have an access token. You can target any site in that tenancy where you have permissions. But now your code, just like S2S, is going to be required to create, or not even create, but retrieve and manage access tokens. Now, here are the security tokens that are going to be involved. There is the context token, there is the refresh token, and the access token. As I go through this next slide, we're going to kind of see how all these pieces fit. But the context token is what gets pushed to your start page, which gives you your security context, and it's what makes OAuth so great, and over in S2S, you're like, gosh, I wish I had that context token coming to me, because then I wouldn't have to authenticate the user. Now, what we really need is an access token. So when you get past a context token, inside there, there's something which is called a refresh token. It's basically a voucher that you can use to go back to an authentication server, which is Windows Azure ACS. You pass it the refresh token, and it passes you back the access token. Okay, one extra token I'm not going to be able to get into in this session because of time is the authorization code, which is there to support the Elevate on-demand scenarios where all of a sudden the app has permissions 1, 2, and 3, but it needs 4. And so there's a way to basically ask for 4 on the fly and basically prompt the user with a screen to give you that permission, at which point you can then get an authorization token back and use that. Okay, now here's the flow that we have to look at. Now, let's say we have this scenario. And in our particular scenario, we have a user. And our user goes to a particular SharePoint site right here. So what I'm going to do for this demo is to go look at my tenancy up in Office 365. Let's go ahead and put in my information there. SharePoint confessions. We all have a few on Microsoft.com. And obviously, my password is Buffy. Okay. And so now, as we get inside here, and what have we just done? We've authenticated against SharePoint. So what we're going to see is the very first part of the process is that user goes to a SharePoint site, and it creates a claims token. SharePoint knows who that user is, and it's kind of going back and forth. Now, the next thing that's going to happen, sorry, I keep switching back and forth between these, but the next thing that's going to happen is this user is going to look at a particular tile inside here and click on that. And then there's this interchange between the client and SharePoint, where SharePoint will retrieve what's called a context token. So when the user clicks on that tile, SharePoint will then call to this cloud-based authentication service, which we call Windows Azure ACS, and it will say, I need a context token. And as it creates the context token, there are 3 important GUIDs. There is, well, they're not all GUIDs, but basically there's the identity of the user, there is the GUID of the host web, and there's the GUID in the tenancy. So when it calls into ACS, it says, please build me a context token that's specific to this user, this host web, and this tenancy. And so the context token gets passed back to SharePoint. SharePoint will then get that context token out behind the page inside the browser and then redirect to your app and the start page and pass the context token inside there. Now, when it passes the context token to the start page, you're able to grab the context token. I'm going to show you how to program against it in just a second. But the idea is that if you have a context token, either through using utility code that makes everything transparent, or if you're kind of a low-level security programmer, you can pull the refresh token out of the context token. You then pass the refresh token to ACS. And because we have a private key, we've used that private key and some encryption techniques. So when we pass it over there, ACS, who's the one who created the context token, put in the context token, you know, basically ACS is able to do some validation. And at that point, it just returns back this access token to you. And so now you can use that access token to call back into SharePoint into any site you have permissions to. And then you can call, you can get a table or a list back, create an HTML table, bring that back to the user. You know, so basically that's how the flow goes. Now, one of the things that I wanted to do in this next demo, sorry I'm going a little bit over, probably go for about another 5 minutes. I figured it was the end of the conference, and I did tell you I wanted to finish you off, so excuse me for going a little bit extra. But let's go ahead and open up this other project and kind of show some examples of working with OAuth inside here. Now, in this case right here, let's go back to... sorry about that. Let me go back over here to this demo. And inside of this particular demo, now this particular user is going to click on this right here. And got Fiddler. Let's go ahead and take Fiddler and do a remove all. Let's now come back here. And what we're going to see is that there's this particular call. I can basically look at this and using Fiddler and looking at the request, you know, I can see all kinds of things that are coming through inside here. If we look at the raw view, there's this thing which is a form variable, which is the SP app token. Now, in this demo code I wrote, it's kind of more of a proof of concept app. What I wanted to do is basically just take all the relevant contextual security information and just display it so we can see what it looks like. So we see that when our start page gets posted to, it passes in this SP app token, which is basically the context token in a Base64 encoded format. Now, from that context token, let's go ahead and kind of see how we can start seeing what's inside there. You know, so here is an example of some code right here. And so what we're able to do is use this class that's automatically injected into provider-hosted and auto-hosted apps when we create them in Visual Studio. And it has a get context token from request. And so this just gives me back this big string that's illegible to us. But what we can then do is say token helper read and validate context token. And now I have a strongly typed object and I can start getting various pieces of information. So what pieces of information can I get inside here? If I look at this, you know, you can see that the context token, you know, gets sent across the network in this form. You know, but once they decode it, they can turn it into basically a JavaScript JSON token, which is called a JSON web token or a JWT. Now, what do we have? We have things like, here is the realm. So basically, that's the GUID of my tenancy up in Office 365. They give you a endpoint. So when you have a refresh token and you want to go and retrieve a access token, you have an endpoint right here. We have the target principal name inside here. I'm not sure if you can see this, but there's this cutesy little office inside there. So basically, that is the top-level GUID of the identity management system, you know, in Windows Azure ACS. And then also I can see something that this context token is basically valid for 12 hours, and then here is the refresh token here at the bottom. And so now we're able to take the refresh token in several different ways. You know, here's one right here, token helper, get access token. Token helper, get app only access token. Now, what's a little bit strange here is when you say token helper, get access token, it gives you back an access token that is a .NET object. You can't pass a .NET object, so then you have to say access token.access token to actually get the string that we use when we make calls across the network. I can also get the app only access token. One little helpful piece of information is when you're back to S2S, there's no thing that says app only. You only have the ones that at first you think only give you the app and user. But if you just basically have a null value for the user, it does give you an app-only token. So, you know, with the OAuth, they have explicit things to get the app-only token. You just kind of have to know that secret trick when you're doing the S2S. Well, now, here's another issue. Let's say that I'm not creating a single-page app. And what I would recommend is you create a single-page app, because then the context token just sits behind there, and you don't have to worry about it. But let's say that I want to go from page to page in my remote web. Well, what's going to happen is I'm going to take the context token and drop it on the floor and not be able to get it. So as we move into this space right here, what's going to be, you know, an optimization is to basically take tokens and start caching them so we don't have to keep going back to ACS. Now, here's one of the big benefits of S2S. Remember, you got the printing press. You just create the access token and pass it. Here, we have to call over there, get the access token, bring it back. Now, if I have something like the host web URI or an app-only access token, well, I can cache that kind of on a shared basis. So I'm just using the ASP.NET cache object. However, anytime you have something that's sensitive to the user, you need to store that either in user cookies or I'm stored it in session state right here. And another great piece of feedback that Sesha gave me is that my code can work here, but it kind of assumes a single tenancy. So if you're going for the home run to create the app that's going to be, you know, installed by thousands of different tenancies, well, you're going to have to start tracking the tenancy ID to make sure that you're not kind of confusing things and going across tenancies. Because the user is going to have this identifying string, and there's different GUIDs, but just, you know, what we never want is to take a refresh token or access token for one particular user or one particular tenancy, and by mistake use it when a call comes in and we don't have the exact same context inside there. Okay, so what we have here is this ability to get access tokens. There's also a CSOM way, I don't have a code sample, but there's a fairly straightforward way where if you've dropped the context token and you're in the remote web, CSOM will give you basically an app context object that gives you a URL which you can use to basically redirect back to SharePoint that will then redirect back to you with a context token. So you can basically reestablish context. And if you don't put a redirect URL, it will put you back to the start page. But when you use this technique, you can also put a redirect URL. So if you're on page 3, you can basically redirect, get back there, and get the context token back. But now, finally, let's go ahead and kind of end up with, you know, here is an example of making a CSOM call inside there, where with CSOM, it's pretty easy, because we just call get client context with access token. When we make REST calls, that's a little bit more difficult. And remember, I didn't show you the REST call with S2S. It pretty much works the same way with OAuth and S2S once you get the access token. It's just how we get the access token is very different between them. But when we're using REST calls, remember, you know, I would definitely prefer to use CSOM instead of REST when I'm in server-side C# code. It's definitely a preference, you know, not a hard and fast rule. But one of the tough parts is that you then have to say headers add authorization bearer space, and then you put that access token string inside there. You know, so once you've got the access token attached to that authorization header, then you're just basically making CSOM and REST calls, and everything's working great. Okay, so now we're in the home stretch right here, and what I was doing is kind of showed you this right here. I'm going to give you an email address at the end if you want this code. I'm also going to give the code to the conference people so that they're able to kind of get you so that you can kind of get this code and run that. Now, just finishing up, when you have an auto-hosted app inside here, one of the really nice things about auto-hosted apps is that you don't have to worry about the registration of the app security principle. In fact, there's no way you could register the app security principle because it's not until an auto-hosted app gets installed where they figure out where to put the remote web. So one of the things that they do, in addition to standing up your remote web, is they basically register the app security principle on the fly. So notice that there's no GUID. GUID's handled after you're finished as far as your responsibilities go. And then once again, they will automatically update this, not just Visual Studio, but up in Office 365, when you install auto-hosted apps, it also does this auto-update for the client ID value. So it's really with the provider-hosted apps where you have to do more work. So with the provider-hosted apps, we have to know where we're hosting this thing from. Should be HTTPS. And if you ever want to use Office 365 for host webs, there's no way to turn down the requirement of HTTPS. And then we have to have pre-registered the app security principle. So we have the GUID inside there. And then over on this side right here, we have the client ID. We have the client secret. And these are both values that are used by the token helper class as it's interacting with ACS. Okay. So I've already kind of looked at some of these programming things. So there's just one more slide I want to get to. And I'm not sure if you want to make some remarks on this too, Sasha. But Sasha was explaining to me kind of their future of where they're headed. So why don't I kind of butcher what you told me yesterday, and then I'll let you correct me. You know, but we have this issue right now where S2S, you know, has a positive side, and that's very performant because you're creating the access tokens and making calls directly in. But the downside is you have to do a dual authentication of the user. So that's kind of a drag. We look over to OAuth, and with OAuth, we don't need to authenticate the user, but we have all these round trips, and now we have to create these caching schemes. And can you imagine how many times over the next couple years that junior engineer Jimmy's going to get this wrong, and you're just going to have the wrong context token? You know, so we're kind of in an unfortunate space where it really requires a lot of expertise to do things correctly inside there when it gets to security programming. So kind of the future, you know, is to be able to kind of get the best of both worlds. S2S where we don't have to keep calling into ACS, but also OAuth. And so there's this idea of being able to create tokens that are added to pages that kind of give us the benefits of both. Now, you don't have the luxury of a microphone right here. Yeah, so tell you what. Because he doesn't have a microphone, why don't we go ahead and just wrap up right here. And like I said, both of us are happy to stay here until the casino closes to answer your questions right here. Other than that, don't forget about your evaluations. You've lived through another SPC. Congratulations to everybody here.